Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Neighbors are calling her the weird lady who lived across the hall, but they didn't think she was dangerous. And today, the man she's accused of plotting to kill says she sounds like an amateur. But FBI agents say Colleen LaRose, the blonde, blue-eyed, suburban Philadelphia Muslim convert who called herself Jihad Jane online, is a domestic terrorist who recruited Muslim extremists in the U.S., Europe, and South Asia, and traveled to Sweden last year to try to kill a cartoonist who depicted the Prophet Muhammad with the body of a dog. Carrie Johnson is Justice Department reporter for The Washington Post. Carrie, walk us through this. You write that FBI agents first talked to Colleen LaRose last July. She's accused of then traveling to hatch her plot in Sweden a month later in August. She returned to the U.S. and was arrested in October. So why was the FBI talking to her in the first place?
Well, she appears to have come on the law enforcement radar screen far earlier than that. It appears from a public reading of the indictment against her, which was unsealed Tuesday, that they had been monitoring her postings on YouTube, on internet message boards, on MySpace, and other sites that had grown increasingly aggressive over the last year or so.
And do we know how she might have been radicalized? What might have converted her?
Well, she appears to have led a rather checkered life. She's a high school dropout. She had some run-ins with the law in South Texas, where she lived. She's been married at least twice. But over the last couple of years, authorities are telling me, she grew more attracted to Muslim extremist beliefs. And we found a posting online in December 2007 in which Fatima LaRose, one of her online handles, according to the FBI, was looking for advice about how to bring in to the U.S. an Egyptian boyfriend she had been corresponding with online for more than a year.
Well, I mean, it sounds incredibly, if true, like a case of bad online dating.
Well, it appears she may have been lonely, although authorities say she was living with a gentleman outside of Pennsylvania and reached out through the internet for connection with like-minded individuals.
Well, and that gentleman, Kurt Gorman, is in shock. He told the Philadelphia Daily News that she did not talk about international events, just moved out. Now, FBI agents are saying that she hid her computer, left for Sweden a month after they questioned her, joined an online community that this Swedish cartoonist hosted. So we had a question. Were authorities following her throughout this?
I think it's safe to say that she was under heavy surveillance, both electronic and otherwise, after she came onto the FBI's radar screen. And there is an account in the court papers of some of her movements and activities while she was in Europe last summer. So it's quite clear that she was being monitored both by officials in the U.S. and also Sweden and possibly Interpol as well.
Well, she returns to the U.S., obviously did not assassinate the cartoonist, and in October was arrested. Why was the indictment sealed for so long? Is she cooperating with authorities? Do you know?
It's not clear from the court papers whether she is, in fact, cooperating with authorities. But she was picked up last October 2009, on a public criminal complaint, which is a less a difficult charging document for authorities to get on a person than an indictment. An indictment requires a grand jury. She was arraigned in October 2009, appointed a public defender, and she's been in custody since that time. The indictment, the grand jury indictment in Philadelphia, was only handed down about a week ago, and it was made public yesterday when several people in Ireland, according to the Irish press, who may have been in cahoots with Ms. LaRose to assassinate this Swedish artist, were also picked up in early morning raids.
We know the police in Ireland are questioning those suspects. What are intelligence experts saying they see in this arrest?
Well, Ms. LaRose represents something that U.S. law enforcement and the intelligence community have been concerned about for some time, which is to say somebody can blend in to American society and Western society because they don't look different than the vast majority of people here. She also could travel freely. She had an American passport and apparently was intent on recruiting people online who had a similar ability to blend in Western Europe and elsewhere. She asked people about travel restrictions and passports. She was trying to recruit for this plot and others potentially. And as a result, some national security experts have told us at the Washington Post that this underscores for the FBI that they need to run down every lead and every tip, no matter how far-fetched it might sound.
Carrie Johnson, Justice Department reporter for the Washington Post. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, today we want to take a look at a slice of the business world that seems to be doing well. Maybe you've noticed at the newsstand there are fewer newspapers, more magazines. In January, despite the economy, 56 new magazines hit the stands. And recently, leading magazine publishers posted a video on YouTube announcing an ad campaign extolling the health of their industry, despite what bloggers say.
They continue to predict the death of the magazine and any other media to anyone who will listen.
But the rumors of our death are, as an old magazine guy once said, greatly exaggerated.
Industry giants, including Kathy Black of Hearst Magazines and Jan Wenner of Wenner Media, talking about the vitality of their industry and magazines in general. Joining us now is Professor Samir Husni, director of the Magazine Innovation Center. Who knew? At the University of Mississippi School of Journalism. He's often called Mr. Magazine. Professor Husni, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And just so tell us, how does it work? Do you agree that it does work differently for magazines?
Definitely. And the funny part of the entire thing is that we have now more magazines than we've ever had in the history of this country. Back in 1980, we had 2,000 consumer magazines available for the general public on any newsstand. You go to a newsstand, you'll have your choice of one out of 2,000. Now we have more than 9,400 last year alone.
But are they healthy? I mean, first of all, we see a gourmet folding. And then I'm reading in a recent New York Times article, Newsweek is down 41%, Time down 34%. This is in sales. Good Housekeeping down 30%, Redbook down 30%, Smart Money down 37%. It seems as if maybe more are coming, but are they cutting into sales for others?
Well, definitely. And if we learned anything from history, which is the sad part in our industry, that we have very short historical memories. Back when the leading magazines in this country were like Life, Look, The Saturday Evening Post in the 50s and early 60s, magazines decided to go on that campaign to compete with television. They ignored their customers who count and started counting customers. They started sending magazines for free, reducing the subscription rates, bombarding the market with their copies until they died. I mean, they committed suicide. When the internet became full-blown, magazines did the same thing. They started competing with the internet, trying to give everything for free on the internet, looking for just increasing traffic and hoping that advertisers will come. That did not happen. What happened is we created this welfare information society. We have put people on welfare information for more than 10 years.
Meaning that it's free.
And then we discovered that, free is not a good business model. Yeah. Now how can we get them to pay? So the numbers that you've mentioned, which are all true and correct, gourmet folded. But at the same time, a new magazine called Food Network, launched in November of last year, was able to reach 1.1 million copies. It took like 74 years for gourmet to reach 975,000.
And so why is that? Why did the Food Network magazine do so well?
Because it adapted to the philosophy that we're no longer competing with another medium. We're complementing each other. You have the Food Network television station. People love it. People watch it. People get addicted to the celebrities, the chefs. People are already addicted to food. You feed both addictions. And guess what? You have a magazine that reflects that addiction, a magazine that solidifies the fact that the people who receive the magazine are members of that Food Network, which is a very important part of why the magazines that survive and excel do that. It's like a membership card coming to my house every single month.
Right. You say that's what makes magazines, and I agree with you, that's what makes a magazine different from even a newspaper, that it's something that, I don't know, there's something about it. You do want to curl up with it as opposed to read it online.
In most magazines, we're not chasing the news. I mean, we are your friend. I mean, you look for us, you can't wait for this issue to come. Whether you are a kid waiting for your highlights, that you know it's coming on this day of the month, you can't wait for it to arrive home. You open the door, you welcome it, you hug it, you take it to your chair and sit down and read it, or whether it's a magazine like the Food Network, or a magazine like Cooking with Paula Deen, or a magazine like Scientific American, whatever community member you are. But our leaders in the industry, until recently, have surrendered all these great terms that we use to describe magazines: community makers, interactive.
Community makers, I like that. And you also say magazines should be considered experiences.
I mean, I tell my students, even in journalism classes, we're no longer just in the business of delivering information. We are experience makers. I mean, newspapers today cannot survive on telling me what happened yesterday, because what happened yesterday is coming on my BlackBerry, on my iPhone, as it happens. They have to tell me what's in it for me. And that's what the great magazines provide, is they provide that answer to that simple question. What's in it for me? When I get Cosmopolitan or when I get Men's Health, what's in it for me? And the answer is so loud and clear that you don't have to search for it, like we are doing with some of the newspapers these days.
Well, some might say, Professor Husny, again, Mr. Magazine, that you might have a slightly more optimistic view of magazines because, again, you're at the Magazine Innovation Center, and which would not exist if magazines went under. But there seems to be, you know, a lot of proof of what you're saying, that magazines keep springing up. I mean, we're hearing that there are now two brand new magazines, two magazines about raising chickens at home.
Yes, yes. And that's, every time I say that I've seen the end of specialization, something sprout out or hatches, to use a chicken term, and say, hey, look at me. I am the new chickens magazine, freshly hatched, premier issue, or I am your backyard chicken magazine. See, magazines have always been the best reflector of American society, of pop culture. When I came to America in 1978 and I started doing what I was doing in my old country in Lebanon, collecting first editions, studying magazines, studying what makes magazines tick, click, and stick with their customers, the first thing I've noticed is that I can tell you by visiting a newsstand who lives in this area, what do they do, how do they spend their fun time, how do they spend their leisure time. And in the early 80s, when I started doing my books about the new magazines, sex was the number one category. I mean, there were more new sex magazines published in this country than any other category.
Really? More than weight loss?
More than anything you want. Until the internet and cable television and satellites start coming in, sex was all over the place. It started going out, and then sports started coming out because cable television created so many new sports that we did not know anything about. Squash or racquetball, and all of a sudden there's one or two magazines for squash. There's one or two magazines for racquetball. Then September 11 happened, and the country cocooned on itself. And what became the most number one category in new magazines? Crafts, hobbies, food, and home.
What trends do you see now? What are some of the new titles and trends now?
I mean, the hottest trend now, is the food magazine. I mean, you can create any food magazine with or without a celebrity attachment to it, and it's doing very well. I mean, if you look at Every Day with Rachel Ray, 1.7 million circulation in less than 4 years. Huh. If you look at Cooking with Paula Deen, almost 1 million in less than 3 years. The folks from Wisconsin launched a magazine called Culture about cheese. Then somebody else launched Cheese Connoisseur magazine. Some guys in Chicago felt there is not a Muslim magazine for men. They launched Muslim Quarterly this month.
Oh, I can see, though, someone buying Culture thinking it's about the arts and it's about cheese. But the question is, will it last? Because you tell us these are sometimes just trial balloons. That's Samir Husny of the University of Mississippi, Mr. Magazine. We'll be back with much more with him. Also later, a reminder, an American peace activist family takes Israel to court. We'll have that story as well. Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're all familiar with what's been happening at newspapers across the country: shrinking ad revenue, fewer reporters. So why are new magazines appearing on the newsstands? Our guest is Mr. Magazine, Samir Husny, a professor at the University of Mississippi School of Journalism. He runs the Magazine Innovation Center there. And Professor, before the break, you were talking about all the new magazines that are out there. So how does that square with the fact that newsstand sales and magazine circulation are both falling?
Well, because the bigger that pie becomes, the more choices you have, the less buying you are going to do from any single topic. I mean, do we really need 23 magazines about tattooing in this country? I mean, do we need 55 magazines about scrapbooking? My son-in-law is a sneaker addict. I mean, he has, I mean, I collect magazines and neckties. He collects sneakers. I mean, he gets 3 magazines. He will kill to get them and get so upset if they are late arriving on the newsstand. One called Sneaker Freaker. It's an 80-page digest magazine that costs $12.
Huh. Oh, sneakers.
But if it's late one time, if he can't find it, he go nuts.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the addictiveness that magazines provide. It's unlike any other medium because nobody needs a magazine, but magazines have become like chocolate. Nobody needs chocolate, but try to get me not to eat chocolate every single day.
Well, and we didn't even mention the whole genre of magazines that I call Jennifer Aniston, that wouldn't exist without Jennifer Aniston or Brad or those people.
You know, the funny thing, we are the only country in the world we refer to those magazines as celebrity magazines. The rest of the world call them gossip magazines.
By the way, that whole subset, the Brangelina, Jennifer, you know, magazines, are they seeing some sort of a peak because of those three people?
Yes. How much do you really want to know about Brad or about Angelina or whether are they staying together or that? I mean, now the latest twist in the story is, of course, that her dad is back in her life.
Oh, boy.
I mean, what's in it for me?
But I'm not actually kidding. I mean, it would seem that without those three, that those might be, you know, types of magazines that would really drop in sales.
Yeah, but if you really look at it, celebrities have always sold magazines, but their lifespan is very short. In my days, you know, when the Beatles or Elvis magazines were coming into the marketplace, you expected those magazines to be there for 10, 15 years. Now, I mean, which celebrity is in the limelight more than like 18 months or 2 years or 3 years max, and they are gone? I mean, when was the last time you heard anything about Britney Spears? In the reality television shows and in the celebrity world, we've become also marketeers who actually create and invent those celebrities, rise them up whenever we feel like it, and then when the role is over, you know, we see the end. And then somebody else new is coming up.
We're talking with Professor Samir Husni, also known as Mr. Magazine. He teaches about magazines at the University of Mississippi School of Journalism. And we know recently for your website, MrMagazine.com, you interviewed Fortune Magazine managing editor Andy Serwer. He agreed with you on the things magazines have to do to survive. Consolidate titles so you don't have so many titles. Eliminate duplication. Again, make sure you create an experience for readers. But what about what we pay for magazines? It seems as if, especially when it comes to subscriptions, they're just giving them away.
Yeah, and that's why I coined the phrase that we have created our own welfare information society. The majority of magazine publishers in this country are either in a state of coma or they are on a methodological dream that they think one day they are going to wake up. And the business model that worked so well from World War II until September 2008 is going to continue working. That advertising-supported model died in September 2008. Advertising is not going to come back to the magazine industry like it used to be. We have now to start changing our model. We have to start looking for customers who are willing to pay the price of a magazine. I cannot afford anymore to pick up a magazine on the newsstand. Like last month, I picked up a copy of Interview magazine, the Andy Warhol magazine.
Right.
Cover price was $9. $9 for one copy. I opened it, and then, you know, the card dropped to the floor, right. The subscription card. I bent over to pick it up, and it screamed at me, "You stupid Samir. You are paying $9 for one copy. Well, if you give us $7, we will send you an entire year."
You're saying magazines have to start really charging for subscriptions.
You know, the price of free, I mean, that's why I laugh. I laugh so hard when I hear any of our quote-unquote experts in our industry talking about, oh, we need to start charging online. Let's start charging first for print.
Yeah.
I mean, we have not charged for print for almost 50 years. We have been given the majority of American magazines away for free just to get the numbers so the advertisers can come and subsidize it. In most of European countries, 70 to 80% of the revenues of a magazine comes from circulation, subscribing to the magazine, and then advertising is more like the gravy. They get 20%, 30%. In our country, almost 80%, if not more, of the revenues come from advertising. When I came to America in 1978, I had 3 channels at home. I knew exactly what I want to watch, I knew exactly at what time, and I knew how much time I'm spending on television. Now I have 660 channels at home. I have no earthly idea what to watch, and I don't even have time to sit down and flip through the 660 channels. We are facing the same thing now with the magazine industry. We have options, options, options. We don't have a business model that's working. We have a business model that died, and then you wonder why the big magazines are hurting. Same thing exactly happened in the 60s. All the big magazines died. We had a new slew of magazines. I mean, Rolling Stone was born, Ms. was born, New York Magazine was born. All these magazines came on the ashes of all these other magazines that died. Same thing is happening now. See, why do we accept as a fact that everything that happens in this world have a life cycle? There's a time for it to be born, a time for it to die. Except when it comes to magazines. If you hear a magazine died, everybody starts mourning and crying, oh, my God, it's the end of the magazine business. It's the end of that magazine, but there's way too many coming on the marketplace.
Well, who knew there was that much to learn about the magazine industry? That's Professor Samir Husni. He studies trends in the magazine industry, and you can follow his findings at our website, hereandnow.org. We'll link you to his blog. Professor Husni is director of the Magazine Innovation Center at the University of Mississippi School of Journalism. He's known as Mr. Magazine. Professor Husni, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Fascinating. By the way, if you have a favorite specialty magazine, either now or in the past, go to hereandnow.org and let us know. Latest news is next, Here and Now. Strapped school districts are laying off teachers, cutting transportation and school hours, and, as is the case here in Boston tonight, deciding whether or not to close some schools. But tonight, the school board in Kansas City, Missouri, will decide whether to close as many as half the 61 schools. Half of the schools? How could that be? Well, there's a $50 million school budget shortfall, for starters. In 1985, a federal judge ruled that the largely minority district was underserved and ordered the state and district to come up with a desegregation plan. The district decided to attract white kids from the suburbs to the inner-city schools by making those schools state-of-the-art. They built recording studios, Olympic-sized pools, even a mock courtroom, close to $2 billion worth of physical improvements. It didn't work. Critics say some schools should have been closed sooner, but now that the 1986 court order, or 85 court order, has expired, as many as 29 may close. Sylvia Maria Gross is with KCUR Radio in Kansas City. And Sylvia, we've heard by some accounts some kids were drawn to the school, so was it the fancy facilities?
I think some kids were drawn by the facilities, but there still was an achievement gap between the white students that came from the suburbs and the black students that mostly lived in the district at that time. And so overall, education didn't improve for the kids that lived in the city.
Well, not only that, it didn't balance the racial equation. We understand that in 1977, the district was 73.4% minority. 25 years after that court order, 85.9% of the student body is minority. And enrollment has fallen.
It has. It just continued to fall, white flight, black flight, Latino flight, as the controversy over the desegregation lawsuit and over the attempts to improve schools has just continued. The reputation of the school district has just gone down.
Even though you say some of these schools do stand out, one in particular, Lincoln Prep?
Lincoln Prep was just named to the list of the 1,500 best high schools. It's within the top 150. There have been specialized programs that have been successful. So communities of parents and educators that have flocked together to create good schools. There's some Montessori schools that have been successful, an African-centered program that's pretty unique. But overall, the quality of most of the schools in the district has been really poor.
Well, what's the debate here? You know, what's the criticism, first of all, of the decision to fulfill the judge's order by attracting kids from the suburbs to the inner city by building these facilities? Are people now questioning, you know, should we have just gone to old-fashioned busing or used other methods to fulfill his mandate?
I don't know that people are actually going back to think that there was another solution. There are some long-standing, very bitter feelings about that whole time and how it all played out, the fact that the city wouldn't raise taxes to help support its own schools. And people feel that there were some underlying racial tensions that were probably never resolved.
Well, and there's no question in reading the accounts the schools were underserved. We read that the kids in the inner city schools didn't get their books, for instance, until the kids in the largely white schools had finished with them. So there was a problem. But you mentioned taxes. We thought that part of the court order was that the district raised taxes to help pay for the plan, but that voters voted those raises down.
And this was controversial because the people in this city said that the court couldn't order taxes, that it had to be the citizens who voted for them, and they didn't.
So, Sylvia, how are parents and students reacting to this?
Surprisingly, there are a number of parents and even students who do understand that the quality of most of the schools is pretty poor, but there are a number of programs that are either moderately successful or quite successful, and the superintendent wants all of the programs in the city to reduce in size, to be fair. And so those parents of the successful programs are the ones who are the most upset because they'd like to see the opportunity for those programs to grow.
Well, we understand 700 jobs will be lost if half the schools are closed. 280 teaching jobs will be lost, and the teachers' union says that they recognize that schools need to be closed. Again, with hindsight, is anyone saying, gee, maybe another way we could have gone was to put all that money into books and teachers instead of recording studios and fencing clubs?
Well, it seems like that's the one thing that really didn't get focused on, and the money really didn't go into teacher development.
Reporter Sylvia Maria Gross of KCUR in Kansas City, Missouri. The school board there is going to be meeting this evening to decide whether or not to close half of the district's schools. Sylvia, thanks so much.
No problem.
Okay, just ahead, the family of that American peace activist killed in Israel while protesting the demolition of Palestinian homes. That family goes to court in 30 seconds, here and now. Vice President Joe Biden met with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas today in the West Bank and again condemned Israeli plans to build 1,600 new homes in traditionally Arab East Jerusalem. Biden traveled to the region to help restart talks between Palestinians and Israelis after a 14-month deadlock. But yesterday, Israel's Interior Ministry announced the plans for the new homes, and that derailed the talk about talks. Meanwhile, contested homes are also central to a court case that begins today as an American family sues Israel for the death of their daughter. You might remember 23-year-old peace activist Rachel Corey of Olympia, Washington. She was crushed to death in 2003 by an Israeli army bulldozer as she tried to stop the demolition of Palestinian homes in Gaza. The bulldozer driver said he never saw her. BBC Middle East correspondent Paul Wood is covering this story, and he has more from Jerusalem.
We are international human rights observers from the United Kingdom and from the United States of America. Please do not shoot!
2003. These are international peace activists trying to stop Israeli military bulldozers. This is what Rachel Corey was in Gaza to do. She explained her motivation in an interview shortly before her death.
I've been here for about a month and a half now, and this is definitely the most difficult situation that I've ever seen. People's lives here are almost completely controlled by the Israeli government, and it's amazing that people are able to hold on to their humanity as much as they have.
Israel says Rachel was warned to leave what was a closed military zone. Her family say the army was reckless to use bulldozers, knowing the peace activists were still there. It cost Rachel her life. We spoke to her mother, Cindy, and her father, Craig. He explains first what the family hoped to achieve with the court case.
Well, we've been asking for essentially justice for 7 years since Rachel was killed. So now it's finally come to court, and of course we want to, A, find out the information, and B, have some accountability on the part of the Israeli government. When Rachel was killed, what we know was that the two bulldozers retreated to the border because they couldn't disperse the internationals that were there, and they got new orders. It's something to the effect of not letting the internationals stop them. They weren't to be there. So don't let them stop you from the work. And by the Israeli Defense Force testimony, 5 minutes later, Rachel was killed. So with that order, apparently something changed, and Rachel didn't know the change.
Rachel has opened people's eyes somewhat to the issue. Maybe it's how she told the story. And then what the outcome, I mean, for her actually was, I think that it resonates, the story resonates for people in that way. I don't think most Americans think about that very often. So it's important for us to think about our role there, and I think Rachel's story has helped us to share that.
The Israeli army says it was not demolishing Palestinian homes that day, but flattening ground so that suicide bombers could not reach Jewish targets. There were 26 suicide bombings in 2003, the year of Rachel Corrie's death. The Israeli military spokeswoman, Lieutenant Colonel Avital Leibowitz.
In that period of time, in 2003, we had no choice but to protect ourselves, and also the civilians, the Israeli civilians that were living inside the Gaza Strip. Therefore, we had to take many measures in order to prevent terrorist activities. Leveling the terrain was one of these measures.
Rachel Corrie's family have always maintained there was never a fully transparent investigation into her death in 2003. The Israeli military denies that, but 7 years on, the family hope that with their day in court, they will finally get what they see as a proper accounting of what happened to Rachel.
The BBC's Paul Wood in Jerusalem. Jazz legend Ella Fitzgerald was honored by two presidents. She won 13 Grammys and sold over 40 million albums in her 50-plus years in the music business. But this is an Ella not many got to hear.
You wanna go to Sugar Hill and holler.
Ella Fitzgerald singing the Duke Ellington Billy Strayhorn favorite A-Train, part of a treasure trove of songs recorded live in 1961 and 62 at the Crescendo, a small jazz club in Los Angeles. Critics say this is Fitzgerald at her most relaxed, most playful, improvising as never before. Well, Richard Seidel went through the many tapes and produced the box set 12 Nights in Hollywood, Ella Fitzgerald at the Crescendo. He headed Verve Records for 20 years, and he's with us now from the NPR studios in New York on this latest release. Richard, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And when you first heard these songs, these particular songs from these nights at Crescendo, what'd you think?
I've heard lots and lots of Ella Fitzgerald. I worked on many, many Ella Fitzgerald projects, but something about this was just at another level. I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that it was in a club. It was such an intimate setting, and all of her interaction with the audience, it just took on this other aura.
Oh, the shark has pearly teeth, dear, and he shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has MacHeath, dear, and he keeps it out of sight.
She's just having so much fun dancing around with the notes.
Which is kind of what she did every night on every song. And one of the incredible things about it is she sings for virtually every second. There are no solos by the guys in the band, maybe a couple of bars here and there as part of the arrangements, but her invention just continues throughout at the highest possible level.
Well, we know some of the songs from these incredible gigs were released, but largely these tapes were in a Verve vault for decades. In the late 80s, they were rediscovered, but then pushed down the road because of other projects regarding Ella Fitzgerald music. It makes you wonder, I mean, do you wonder, geez, if these have been there all along, what else is there?
There are other tapes. There are at least two or three live sessions, but I've heard most of these, and this one is the primo one.
And we'll have more of Ella Fitzgerald recorded at the Crescendo after a break, here and now. Welcome back.
A tisket, a tasket, a brown and yellow basket. I send a letter to my mommy on the way I dropped it.
And we're with producer and former Verve executive Richard Seidel, listening to selections from 12 Nights in Hollywood, Ella at the Crescendo, a box set of recordings from 1961 and 1962 of live performances at the Crescendo Club in Los Angeles by the late, great jazz artist Ella Fitzgerald, long heralded as the First Lady of Song. Here's a signature piece, Tisket a Tasket.
Hey, Bobber Bebop. Hi-ho, Silver. Oh, that ain't in it. Tisket a Tasket. I lost my yellow basket.
And Richard Seidel, again, the unbridled joy.
In Ella Fitzgerald, compared to almost any other singer you can think of, the joyousness is maybe her strongest characteristic.
Put this in context. When these shows happened at the Crescendo, where was she in her fame?
Well, in those days, artists used to record so much more frequently than they do now. Some years she made 3 or 4 different albums. As far as her popularity, it was at a peak from the mid-50s on, and there are various times in earlier years where she was also extremely popular. And Tisket a Tasket, of course, is her signature song, her first big hit, and the biggest hit she pretty much ever had.
And we just heard her singing it in 1961 at the Crescendo. And in those shows, she also demonstrates her gift with ballads. Here's Ella Fitzgerald, But Not For Me.
They're writing songs of love, but not for me. A lucky star to grow, but not a lot for me.
George and Ira Gershwin's But Not For Me. Richard Seidel, Ira Gershwin once said, I never knew how good our songs were until I heard Ella Fitzgerald sing them. What did she bring to the ballad?
Well, it's interesting. Ella was criticized for not having the same emotional depth in recording or performing ballads as, say, somebody like Billie Holiday. And I guess you could say that to a certain extent that is true, but the ballads on this particular box set seem to take on a poignance that they didn't always at other times when she recorded them.
Well, I'm wondering if, you know, that kind of pathos is a place she just didn't want to go to because she, in some ways, had lived it. We know her early life was difficult, abandoned by a father. Her mother died early. She was abused by her stepfather, taken in at 15 by an aunt in Harlem, no money, dropping out of school, even working as a lookout for a so-called sporting house. So maybe joy is what she wanted to feel after that.
Not every singer has to sing tragic love songs. Not everybody has to sound like Billie Holiday. Not that there's anything wrong with sounding like Billie Holiday, but I think Ella brings a different side of emotions to her work. And it's upbeat, and it's fun. It's playful. A lot of examples of that are to be heard in this box set.
Well, in fact, let's go to probably the most pointed of all, Accentuate the Positive.
To illustrate my last remark, Jonah in the whale, Noah in the ark. What did they do just when everything looked so dark? Man, they said we gotta accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, latch on to the affirmative, don't mess with Mr. In Between.
One of the greatest things about her, of course, is how hard she could swing and the fantastic sense of time that she had. And Norman Granz, her longtime manager and the producer of the original recordings, his nickname for her was Lady Time. And another thing to say about this music is that it proves once and for all, if anybody ever doubted it, that Ella Fitzgerald is the greatest improvising vocalist that has ever lived, on par with any of the great jazz instrumentalists.
Fly. the morning and night you give me fever.
Did you ever meet her?
Yes, I did. That was quite an experience. One of the unreleased recordings that we did put out was a recording that Ella did in Rome in 1958. It was around her birthday, when she was 40 years old. And the record was released in 1988 when she was 70. I got the opportunity to meet her at that time, and I went backstage to greet her. We had a special plaque made up with a number one on the Billboard charts recording. When I introduced myself and I reached out to hold her hand, she was just the sweetest little old lady in a way. And her reaction was, "Oh, wow, I can't believe I have a number one record and I don't even record anymore." And she held my hand for like 5 minutes with all this gratitude. It was just really something to see that a star at her level would have that kind of humility.
Well, and she also had a sense of humor. We've been hearing that through these recordings at the Crescendo Jazz Club in Los Angeles in 61 and 62. Let's listen to her version of Blue Moon.
We'd like to do one of the number one hit songs, ladies and gentlemen, for you.
Wonder what she's saying there about the hits at the time.
I think it's a spoof. I think what was happening in that period was jazz artists sort of had to deal with the fact that the music had changed, that rock and roll was a new thing. And that particular song was on the hit parade, as she says, at that time, in a doo-wop version by a group called the Marcells. Couldn't have been more different than the traditional way of singing it and the way Rodgers and Hart wrote it. But she just has a lot of fun with it, and you can tell by the audience reaction that really works.
And when I look, the moon had turned to go, 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 go. Now I'm no longer alone without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own.
Richard Seidel, you say there's more of this?
There's some more things from these particular nights of recording, but I think we really chose the best stuff. What's also very interesting is that in the 70-odd songs that she did record over those 2 years of engagements at the Crescendo, we only found one song that wasn't up to par, that we couldn't release a version of at all. And many of the 70 songs, there was only one version, and she just nailed it.
What was the one that she didn't? I'm just curious.
Oh, a song called Little Darlin', which is best known as an instrumental by Count Basie, but this version had words.
Okay, one out of 70. Did she ever say, I mean, where the voice came from?
That's a good question. I'm not sure I can answer it except to say that I don't believe she ever studied. It was just something that came completely naturally.
And we get to hear it unvarnished in the box set 12 Nights in Hollywood, part of a treasure trove recorded in 1961 and 1962 at the Crescendo, a small jazz club in Los Angeles. Richard Seidel produced the box set. He headed Verve Records for 20 years. And so, Richard, I'm sure this has been a wonderful project for you. Thanks for telling us about it.
Glad to have been able to do that.
Through the mist of a memory, you wander back. Breathing my name within the sun.